Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And, of course, we want to wish all of our listeners a happy Passover, happy Easter. And the program today strong figures.
Oh, hold on a minute. If you don't believe in either one of those, have a happy day anyway.
Exactly. I'm sure there's somebody. There's something every day of the year.
Well, this program's just for Peter. We've been having a lot of these all gal programs recently, so I decided it was time, and Ann and I had a little arm wrestle, and she let me win. So we're presenting you today's program with three fine gentlemen from the world of food and cooking, and leading off a truly remarkable young man, Brian Voltaggio. He's won all kinds of awards. He has lots of restaurants, having just started out with one called Volt in Frederick. He has several more restaurants, which he talks about. And he talks about the whole concept of all of them, why they're different, what he's trying to cater to. And, of course, on the occasion of publishing his first cookbook, it's his second cookbook, right?
Right.
So he had a cookbook out about his restaurant, Volt. And now he's got a cookbook out called Home, which is how you cook some of his food at home. Ha ha, I wish. But the book's available for you all to try, and I'm certainly going to as well. So here's Brian.
Brian Voltaggio, you must have the cooking gene, because you and your brother are both very well accomplished and acclaimed chefs. Do you think there is such a thing as a cooking gene?
A cooking gene. That's interesting. But there's something possibly to the concept. I think that Michael and I, obviously, we grew up in a family who was in love with food, and it certainly came through in our childhood as very much a part of our upbringing, and ultimately became a mode of survival. So we got into this profession, many people do, either because you don't have a choice in any other, or you fall in love with it, and we kind of fell in love with it at an early age.
Now, your first book, Volt, Inc., you did with your brother Michael, who's in San Francisco, is he?
He's in L.A.
L.A., yes. Right, mm-hmm. Okay. I get those cities mixed up, but they're very different, aren't they? Anyhow, but this now that we're going to be talking about is your own book called Home, subtitled Recipes to Cook with Family and Friends, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. But before, I have a hard time keeping up with you, so maybe our listeners do too. Could you just briefly outline the restaurants you currently have, where they are, and how they're different, what they're serving?
Yeah, of course. So first, I opened Volt in 2008 in my hometown of Frederick, Maryland. And that restaurant, I guess you could call it the flagship, or the sort of the place where all of our new ideas come from. And then shortly thereafter, we opened Family Meal, which seems to be the restaurant we're expanding the most now at this moment. And Family Meal was the answer to the suburb dining for young professionals and families and friends and family to gather around a really great meal to be prepared by, you know, chef-driven concepts using really great local and sustainable organic ingredients, but done in it as a modern take on the American diner. So very approachable food. And after that, shortly, I kind of got the itch to do something that was a little bit more towards my Italian heritage, even though I didn't spend much time in Italy at all. Or did we have, like, we certainly had a lot of influence in our upbringing, food from that area, but not as you would find in traditional Italian-American upbringing where it was the classic Sunday supper. But I think that I always, like, yearned for it and wanted it. And so we created Agio, which is sort of my modern Italian-American take on some of these classic dishes, utilizing ingredients from the area. So we have that in Baltimore and also in Washington, D.C. And we also have Range. Range is, I worked for Charlie Palmer for a long time, and I opened and operated his steakhouse in D.C. for 5 years. And I wanted to create a restaurant that was based on that a la carte format. I really love that style of dining. Center cut meats paired appropriately with different side dishes of your liking and sauces, you know, by choice. And so I created a range that also utilizes off cuts of meat, blood of offal, and other non-traditional steak cuts. And so the idea is it's more about utilizing the entire animal. Then also we open Lunchbox, which is a casual sandwich shop, quick or fast casual restaurant. It's also located in Chevy Chase Pavilion, which is where Range and Agio are also located. So all three restaurants are in one area. And then that's pretty much it. So we have Volt, Range, Agio, Family Meal, and Lunchbox.
Well, you're not getting bored.
All the concepts that we have.
You're not getting bored, are you?
No, definitely not bored. And lots of places to cook, which is good. It keeps me moving.
And you're
opening
another? We
have four locations of Family Meal right now.
What goes in Richmond?
So next to open, which will be opening this spring, we're going to be opening Family Meal in Richmond. So it's my first restaurant that's more than an hour's drive. So this is a new thing for us. It's a great neighborhood, great area. I love the city. There's a lot going on down there, and I'm excited about being a part of it.
Now, are you having trouble staffing any of these restaurants?
No, I mean, each city, it's very different when we're recruiting. We did just open in Ashburn, Virginia, which is just outside of Leesburg, near Dulles Airport. We opened in a really great community over there called One Loudoun. And there, it's a very new neighborhood. It's Northern Virginia is growing so fast, especially in that area, that there isn't a built-in group of hospitality people who are already living in the area. So we're having to reach to have people drive into the area because literally the neighborhood is being built as we are building the restaurant. So
wow.
There, I think it's probably a little bit more difficult, but we're still, that's much like when I opened in Frederick, even though there's a lot of restaurants around here, there just wasn't a lot of longstanding professionals as you would find if you went to a city like New York or Philadelphia or in Washington, D.C. itself, where hospitality is a big part of the city and the fabric of what it's there for. And so there's a built-in infrastructure of staff who's experienced in being cooks and servers and bartenders at this level. And so it does, every time we open a new location, our strategies have to be different. In Richmond, fortunately, we have a lot of great staff already on board early on, and in some areas we're still looking.
Now, in your introduction, you explained your concept of home cooking is right at the top of your list of priorities, right?
Yes, absolutely. Cooking at home is very important. As much as I want people to make reservations, I also want people to cook at home, too.
Yeah, because that is...
You know, cooking at home is it's different. When you're cooking at home and you're creating dishes for your friends and family, there's a connection that's very different than just picking up the phone and making a phone call, ordering out. It's personal. And it's something that the reason why I created this book was not only to help people get used to their kitchen and invite people over again and feel confident, but then also I wanted to leave a list of recipes on the shelf so my wife can cook for my family when I'm working and cooking for everybody else.
Right. It's really funny, Brian. When we interviewed Heston Blumenthal more than 10 years ago now, we asked him what he fixed at home, and he said roast chicken.
Right. No, it's true. I mean, at home it's about simplicity.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, no, but at home is simplicity. Chefs like us, we don't cook. I don't cook the meals that I cook at Volt for dinner at home. My kids would throw it back at me. It's not that the food's not good and delicious. It's just the fact that the food at home is about something that's extremely approachable, comforting, simple to prepare, should be within an hour. You're trying to cook dinner in 30 minutes. It's difficult if you want to have anything that's, you know, fun and adventurous, at least to some small extent. But you carve yourself out an hour, you can create a really great meal.
And your kids like to watch
some of the
you.
Things at Volt take me days. Yeah, so, you know, preparations at Volt take us days to get there.
But your kids enjoy at least hanging around when you're cooking.
Yeah, no, and that's part of the experience of cooking at home. Whether it's friends, family, your children, getting them involved in the prep work, spending that quality time together, preparing a meal that you're going to share, it creates a bond. So it's something that's really important.
But, you know, this might be straightforward and simple home cooked recipes, but they are certainly not ordinary and not without considerable interest. This what is this waffle recipe that looks so fabulous?
Just a straight Belgian waffle. I feel like it's been done 1,000 times.
Uh-huh.
Dishes they're fun, they're thoughtful as a chef would approach the task of creating a new dish. And so I looked at classic things. People that the hook is that, okay, it's a waffle. How hard could it be? But what I did was I incorporated blue crab into the waffle because I think there's something exciting about taking ingredients that are around you and kind of flipping them inside their head. I mean, nobody thinks about crab as a breakfast dish. Mm-hmm. But for brunch, you know, crab baked into a waffle, like you think about a crab cake, it's hot and it's crispy and it's bound with some sort of an egg and a butter sauce because you'd normally dip it in butter and vinegar. And so this is a crab benedict, basically.
Right.
And so the butter sauce, the béarnaise, is a reduction of vinegar and beer emulsified with butter and eggs. Finished with tarragon. There's a soft poached egg over top of the waffle. In the crab waffle recipe, it's a yeasted waffle, so it has this really great flavor and aroma. The crab is folded into it gently, and it baked in the waffle. And what you get is this crispy but soft interior waffle. And then the thing about a crab cake that I really like, you've had like a baked or crab cake before, right?
Right, where sure.
Little bits of the crab kind of stick out, and they kind of get browned and caramelized on the outside. Uh-huh. And then you got the soft, fluffy, white interior crabs. There's two different textures. Well, that happens with the waffle, too. When you're baking the waffle, the crab sticks out. Some of it sticks out, and you get these little brown pieces of crab, and then the interior of the waffle is soft, really great, flaky crab meat. And so it's just a kind of reminiscence of a crab cake. And so it's an iconic Maryland dish created for brunch.
Now, your custom burger here, Brian's Burger, is something worth describing, too. But do you think that people are really going to grind their own meat mixture?
Yeah, so I believe in investing in, typically everybody gets the KitchenAid mixer in their home. If you're even half of a serious cook at home, you have some sort of a mixer, right? Because, you know, trying to make cakes or pies or, well, pies you can make, but I mean cakes, you know, for example, or any types of breads, you typically want a stand mixer. Well, for a relatively small investment, you can get a grinder that would attach to it. I encourage that you grind your own meat. If you don't, you don't have time to do so. There's this pepperoni burger that all you do is you go and you buy the ground meat, and then you just sit there and you brunoise the pepperoni and fold that into it. You're going to get the same result. So you don't actually have to invest in a grinder if you don't want to. But the cool thing is about this is that we're spiking this burger with pepperoni, which already has a really great flavor. Pepperoni comes like, it's like this bomb of flavor. It comes like this small little compact thing that's full of all kinds of stuff that can create layers of flavor for any dish. It has smoke, it has spice, it has meat, it has fat, it has all of those things that you want, you know, into your burger. And rather than just putting bacon on there, which I think, you know, I'd love a bacon cheeseburger, but what happens to me is if it's bacon, it's not placed on the burger properly, it's typically like falling off and it's pulling
it the ingredients
out. It does,
it falls
out.
Off. Yeah.
But I also don't like to grind bacon into the burger because it's too smoky. Uh-huh. It takes away from the flavor of the meat. But pepperoni has a really great balance, but also has a good spice to it. And so grinding the pepperoni into it in this ratio just adds that extra smoky, meaty flavor that you're kind of looking for, that spice, but it's not too overpowering. You still taste the burger. And so it's a really great balance. And then you smash an avocado, fry an egg.
Oh, I love that.
Pepper
yeah.
jack cheese on that thing, and then you got a really good burger.
Now, you've got an extra mess on your hands, though, if you're not careful.
Yeah, it is a big mess, but what burger that's been delicious that you really, really enjoyed didn't drip a little bit on your shirt?
No,
you know? I mean, it's not good unless you got a couple grease stains, right?
The interesting thing is before McDonald's and people like that arrived and spoiled everything, that your traditional Australian diner had a similarly complex burger, and the thing that really made the mess was the fried egg on top.
Yes.
Because it had to be sunny side up so that you could get a certain amount of dribble.
Yeah, you got to be able to.
And yours
is
the same.
Yeah, you know, I like to fry the egg, though, get the butter starting to brown in the pan, and then crack it into it so it gets a crispy white. Like, I like the crispy white, but then I have to leave the yolk soft. So that way when you do smash the bun on top of the burger, it pops. And
oh,
it
no,
starts
you're,
to drip and ooze.
You're absolutely right.
And then just make sure you have plenty
yeah,
of
I know
napkins. That's all I ask.
Yeah, I know there's a fried egg on top of it. That's what made me think back to the years I spent in Australia. And it's yeah. interesting that you fry the eggs that way, because I read Jose Andres quoted in one of the food magazines saying that the way to cook an egg was to have the fat or the butter really hot so that the white got brown and lacy on the outside. So I
yes.
cook my eggs that way, and Ann always says, boy, that looks really good.
That's the best way to cook an egg. It really is. I agree with Jose, and I mean, on many levels, why that egg is delicious. I mean, I like layers of texture. You get the soft yolk. You still get a soft interior of the white, and I love the crispy brown bits of an egg. That's sometimes people do it by accident, mm-hmm. and that's the part that you like. You know what I mean? It's like that thing that you're not supposed to like. Well,
no.
just cook it that way, and then you'll get the egg that you want.
No, what,
you know,
what?
It's like it's just a beautiful way to cook a delicious egg.
Now, Anne's on the page that puzzled her just a little bit.
Yeah, I have never seen anything like these, the grilled watermelon ribs. Do
yeah,
you use the rind? I mean, my grandmother used to pickle the rinds, but that's the only rind I've ever had on a watermelon.
Yeah, so the rind has a really great flavor to it. It almost has a pickled sort of flavor to it. It has like a sharp acidity to it. Sweetness, obviously, is, you know, at the core of the watermelon, and it expands its way out towards it, it gets to the green flesh on the outside. And there's a great structure to that. It's cooked, it becomes tender, so it's really delicious, and it can take on marinade. So in this case, we do this dry rub, scored it, grill it. We take just enough of the skin off and leave just a little bit of the pink hue from the flesh. And then you grill these watermelon ribs, and they're just really delicious. And side by side with like this fajita beef that I have it plated with, this fajita spiked beef, it's a really great flavor combination, because you eat a little bite of the steak and a little bit of bite of the watermelon, and it's a really good one bite dish.
Well, you have so many intriguing tastes. Explain to us your love of mashed potatoes.
Yeah, I have this affection. Well, I guess it probably started because when I was working in New York with Charlie every Thanksgiving, I just told a story like 2 days ago because I got together with a bunch of guys and we're talking about how Thanksgiving used to be at Oriole. It still is. And we used to have to make mashed potatoes for 400 people, and it's a lot. You know, it's a lot of rice and potatoes. But making perfect mashed potatoes, the perfect emulsification, butter, fat, a little bit of cream, and the potato is an art in itself, because you almost have to break the potato and then bring it back in order to get the smooth, creamy texture that you're looking for. And so as a cook, it's something that's kind of a balancing act, and there's some pride even in something as simple as mashed potatoes. I'm a smooth mashed potato guy. I take the time and tammy them and, you know, put them through ricers,
right,
and do the right thing and cook them and dry them out so they're nice and fluffy. But then flavoring them too. It's like, I love just plain mashed potatoes, but I always find myself putting things on it in order to create layers of flavor and texture. And so came up with this idea of these everything mashed potatoes. It was kind of inspired by Michael. He had this seaweed butter that he put into his potatoes. It was actually in Vold Inc. And they were just delicious. I think of that as like a really great surf and turf pairing. I love an everything bagel. I think everything spice is everywhere now, but you can pretty much put it in. But I love the flavor combinations. The garlic and the poppy seeds and the onions and everything else that you find on top of that bagel tastes really good inside potatoes. And so we came up with this everything butter, and we fold it into the mashed potatoes, and it's just delicious.
You really like to eat. I could tell the way you describe your dishes.
Oh, I'd love to eat. I mean, I love to cook. I feel like if you're better at what you do if you actually eat the dishes. So you have to like your food.
Well, you also do something that people will appreciate in this book.
Yeah.
Is that you pick out some holidays, because they're stressful for when you're entertaining, especially large groups. And you do Thanksgiving, which really puts people into apoplexy trying to do a Thanksgiving dinner. And you also do what, the Feast of the Seven Fishes. I'm not sure I forgive you for putting meat in that, because it defeats the whole purpose. It's supposed to be a vegetarian. I mean, not a vegetarian, but a non-meat, a meatless.
A pescatarian holiday. I know. Yes, I know that. And so it is a little bit more non-traditional. Where this kind of came from, the idea of these categories in the book, came from the fact that I am a chef. I own restaurants. I'm typically cooking for other people. I would be a fool to try to fool others to say that, okay, I'm at home every day at 5 o'clock and putting dinner on the table for my family. I wish I could, but I can't. And so these are days that I'm truly at home cooking, where I'm cooking and preparing meals. Breakfast, Sunday supper, that's my day off. Feast of the Seven Fishes is a good example. And on Christmas Eve, I have everybody over to my house.
I want to come, Brian.
Super Bowl.
Brian, can
yeah,
we
I know,
come?
Right?
We're usually in England.
Of course. Usually. Absolutely. No, and Super Bowl to me, that's a food holiday. When you think about Super Bowl, you think about TV commercials and food, unless your team happens to be in the Super Bowl. Other than that, do you care about who's playing? You care about the party, the food, and maybe your brackets. That's about it. And so, to me, it's a cooking holiday, and it's one that should be celebrated, and it's also one that I take off, you know, religiously. And so, that's how I categorize the book. And I you know, like I said, if this was 7 days at home with Brian, then that would be, it wouldn't be an authentic book. These are days that I cook. These are the dishes I do. And this is, you know, how I put it together. And I tried to make the book so, you know, people are inspired to get back in there and use their kitchens again. Pretty adamant about the tagline, pointed out
right
in the beginning of the conversation. These are recipes to cook with family and friends. At first, you know, admittingly, my publisher wanted to write, I thought it was a good idea, recipes to cook or recipes to share with family and friends. Well, the way I look at that is that's a coffee table book. It's on the coffee table, and you're sharing it while you're sitting around with a pizza that you just ordered. That's not what I want. I want you to take the book and take it into the kitchen, not share the recipes that you got when you got Brian's book. These are recipes that you cooked out of his book. And that's what I want to have happen. And so that one word was really important for me to change in that tagline. Because, you know, I wrote it, obviously people suggest things. And so that was kind of a big argument that I had. And I'm glad I won. Because, that's what I want people to do with the book.
Well, we're glad you won too now. Do you have a single website that people can go to get to all your restaurants? Or do they have to go out there?
Yeah, no, certainly. So if you go, to BrianVoltaggio.com, I'll spell it out, you can reach all of the restaurants all in one location. Well, there's the links to actually buy the book if you'd like. But the great thing is that there also talks about some of the things that we do for community, certainly, you know, ongoings in the restaurants. But then also there's my Twitter feed there. So if you're looking for a new dish, I might be putting one out. So it's a good spot to go.
I mean, there's so many. I don't know where to start with this cookbook. I mean, they're going to have to buy it because it's
page one. Page 1 to 297, that's it right there. Well, just go all the way through.
It's wonderful, and I thank you for taking the time to talk to us about it, and hopefully we'll make it on our next date to one of your restaurants, huh?
Well, I would love to have you down and come over to the restaurants, but certainly since if you can't make it to me, then maybe I can make it into your home. So I'm glad you got a copy, and hopefully you enjoy cooking out of it.
I'm excited. And talking to you makes me even more excited. So thanks a lot, Brian.
Thank you.
We'll pause for a quick break, and we'll be right back, so don't go away.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, welcome back, and I must tell you that the publicist for this next author and book told me
he was a real character,
and a very colorful character. This is Carrie Bachman, who we work with a lot, and boy, she didn't disappoint. You talk about an interesting lifestyle. We're going to be talking to Kent Rawlins, who is a cook for cowboys. I think that's what it's called.
Yeah, he's in charge of the chuck wagon. And one of the things that he told us was how important the chuck wagon is. Apparently, the chuck wagon master is the second highest paid person on the crew moving the cattle around.
He's a doctor. He's every kinds of things with.
Yeah, he does lots and lots of things.
Many things, and you'll like particularly his description of making coffee. I think.
Well, when you hear about him, you're going to want to. Believe what your mother said. What was it? Boys don't. No, it's the opposite. Don't grow up to be cowboys.
Oh, right.
You want to grow up to be a cowboy so you can go eat some of his delicious food. And the nice part about it is, listening to this interview and getting hold of his book, you'll be able to learn how to do that.
There is an enormous interest in cowboys and cowboy culture today. I guess that's probably because we're losing so much of it. We're going to be talking today, however, to Kent Rawlins, who is a cookie. He is a cowboy chef. His book is called A Taste of Cowboy, Ranch Recipes and Tales from the Trail. And he was assisted, I hope you don't mind my mentioning, with your wife, Shannon Keller Rawlins. She sounds like a wonderful person.
Oh, she is, ma'am. I'm married way above my head. I'm the luckiest man in the world. I get to do exactly what I want to do every day. I've been doing it, and I have someone that stands by my side that is the most beautiful person in the world.
So you do what you want to do every day. Why don't you tell our listeners what it is exactly that you do?
Well, I think the number one thing that I do is be cowboy, and that's work in Mother Nature's kitchen. She runs the electric bill, she runs the plumbing, she runs it all. And I'm fortunate enough to, through the last 25 years of really cooking with a chuck wagon, to meet thousands and thousands of people from Tampa Bay to British Columbia and from New York to L.A. and have a friend in every state, and that's why I'm truly blessed. I know which ones mean the most, friends or money, and I'll always have far more friends than I have money. And the cowboy lifestyle has instilled that in me from day one. because that's what it was always about.
Well, now, how did you get to be so well known? Bobby Flay challenged you to a SmackDown, or whatever it's called.
A throwdown, yes,
throwdown, ma'am. Throwdown. How did he know about you?
Oh, I'd worked for the Food Network off and on, ma'am, on different things, and they had called several times and sort of wanted to do some stuff, and when they do one of them little throwdowns with Bobby Flay, it's just like it is. You sure don't know he's coming, so I was a little surprised to see him. But when I figured out that he was challenging me to a dish that I cook every day in my kitchen, I'm thinking, well, we'll find out how tough he is when we build a fire. It was 97 degrees before we started, so he got really hot. He's a good sport, but
he was sweating.
Hey, I know how to cook a chicken fried steak.
You say he didn't really know how to cook a chicken fried steak?
Oh, yeah, he did. He just used a different cut of meat than what we normally use. We like to use a sirloin, whether it's the inside of it or the top or the bottom. And, you know, everybody's a little different in chicken fried steak and where it comes from, but the sirloin sure makes the best. And it's been a thing for me through the years that people say, a lot of folks, especially East and North, say, well, is it chicken or is it steak? And I said, it's sure enough steak, I promise. You know, they began to batter meat long ago in the Depression to make it look like it was bigger and go farther.
Oh, is that how it originated?
Yes.
Well, now, it's really funny. Around here, they have a legendary dish called City Chicken.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is sort of similar in a way, except it's certainly not chicken.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But are the two related at all?
I don't know, sir. You know, when I get back east, especially Tennessee and through that country cooking, they call it country fried steak instead of chicken fried steak, you know. So I don't know if they're directly related, but I think they all got something in common, and that's being good.
Now you do two things at the same time. You must be a busy guy, I guess, because you travel around the country with your big truck called Bertha. But are you also on the trail as well?
Yes, sir. We probably fed over 27,000 people off the back of that Studebaker chuck wagon last year, and probably drove about 35,000 miles. We do a lot of catering. Do a few festivals and cook for working ranches because I'm not going to give up the heritage that was instilled in me from being a cowboy, and that's cooking for cowboys. But Bertha's an old cast iron, I mean, just an old wood stove that we haul around, and wagon goes on about a 20-foot trailer, and which the chuck wagon, I tell people, sir, was the first Meals on Wheels ever invented.
Yep.
I'm sure it was.
What gave you the idea to take this up as a trade?
Well, my mother taught me to cook when I was 7, 8, 9 years old, and I sort of took to it. I didn't know I was going to have to wash that many dishes at time. But I like to cook, and sometimes it was a whole lot warmer inside than it was outside. So cooking was pretty nice. I remember some of the old-timers telling my dad, when we'd be somewhere, they'd say, you know, that young boy of yours spends a lot of time in the kitchen. But it's something that was sort of handed to me in the way of the cooking. The method, sure, sort of come about it in a different way. Started guiding elk hunters in the Gila Wilderness, which is in southwest New Mexico, back in the early 80s. And my mother's brother run the outfit, and he knew that my mother had taught me to cook. So when we get up there 27 miles on a mule, we unload a bunch of Dutch ovens and stuff, and he says, hey, you're the cook because I know your mama taught you how. Well, cooking in Dutch ovens is a little different than just cooking in anything else, and especially when you're dealing with Mother Nature. Them hunters eat a few burnt biscuits the first 2 or 3 days, but after that, it sort of took a halt, and I got to thinking of the different wagons and the different cooks that I've known through the years, and I'm thinking, you know, I get out of here one of these days, I'm going to get me a chuck wagon and go to cooking for ranches. And started cooking for ranches, and word got out, hey, this guy's a pretty good cook. And it went from ranches to weddings, to birthday parties, to bar mitzvahs, to everything in the world.
So, and you've achieved a considerable amount of celebrity in addition to this book deal. I mean, you don't see that many. The only book that I see is... what's her name? Ree Drummond, who
yes.
Yeah, and so, I mean, of course, she's came at it from a different perspective. She came at it from blogging because she was stuck on a ranch and not knowing what to do with herself. But she, boy, there's obviously an audience for the kinds of things that she does.
Yes.
I mean, I've never seen so many illustrated steps to mashed potatoes in my whole entire life.
Yeah, I understand, ma'am. I do. For the fact. Ranching is not something that's a hobby for us, or cooking either. Like I say, it's a lifestyle. We've been in places you can't find in a map, be 70 miles from the nearest town. So you learn to manage your groceries and your situation and your menu, because you sure ain't going to run to town and get a dozen eggs right before you need them.
Right.
Unless somebody comes by and lays one in a bird nest for you.
Now, if you're on the road with a cattle drive, how many days does that typically last? And how do you make sure you have enough of the stuff you need to feed all these hungry cowboys?
Well, sir, cattle drives per se is what they were in the olden days, in the 1880s and stuff like that, have totally changed. They don't drive cattle up a trail like the Chisholm Trail, some 900 miles to put them on a rail car. Now you go to a ranch, they have a little more modern transportation to where they can truck cattle different places if they need to after they get them gathered. But the smallest ranch I've cooked on is about 10,000 acres. The largest is about 300,000 acres. The longest I've been on one is 5.5 weeks, me and my little sweet wife Shannon, the Bell Ranch in New Mexico. I figure out how many hands there is, cowboys, that I'm going to have to feed. I know we're feeding 3 meals a day. Make a menu and a grocery list. Always plan for about 2 days extra most of the time, because you never know when Miss Mother Nature is going to throw a kink in things and you might have to stay a little longer than you should. If it's a long stay, we'll send a grocery list to ranch headquarters. Usually the cowboys' wives will go to Costco or a Sam's, something like that, and stockpile the groceries we need. And then somebody will bring them to us from headquarters about once a week. My Frigidaire is an ice chest. My washing machine is a wash tub.
Uh-huh. And you wipe your plates clean. You don't wash them too much, right?
No, we're very clean, sir. That's something, I mean, my mother always told me you can judge a man's appetite and the way you lacked your food by the way your plate comes back to you. Well, when them plates come back to me, and we're on a ranch and anywhere I've ever cooked in the last 25 years, they're clean. Sure, we wash them, but them folks love what I cook, and it goes back to what my mother taught me. Cook what you love, and love what you cook, and you'll be all right, and I do that.
Now, there is a set of ingredients that's sort of standard throughout all your recipes. And I'm wondering I think our listeners would be interested in the kinds of things that go into cowboy cooking the way you do it.
Well, you know, I tell people, they ask, well, you know, you use a lot of canned goods. Well, usually there's not a Walmart nearby, nor is there a garden growing somewhere when we're out in them places. So canned goods has been something that's easily transported that we can have with us for a period of time. Sure, we have some fresh stuff that people bring to us, and a lot of ranches furnish their own beef. So I've always been amazed that people sometimes think that just because it's canned, maybe it's not good. Well, just like this cookbook, we show you how to blend those flavors from a canned good and make it feel like it was the freshest thing in the world. And that's the way I was raised. We had canned goods. Sure, we had some fresh vegetables growing up, but my mother canned everything, so I've always been a canned good fan.
Now, you've got a stable of spicy things, too, that you add, that I guess, in a way, make cowboy cuisine the way it is.
Yeah, I'm one of them kind of people that I like to put a little bite in my food to where it bites back at times. And I think if there was one ingredient that I would reach for more than anything, and I've always found it on every cooking competition I was in, too, on TV, and that's chipotle peppers in adobo sauce.
Oh, yeah.
I like something got a little bite in it. Sure, there's ways to lessen the heat I like to make a relish. There's a green chili relish in there that goes with those grilled pork chops, and it's sweet and it's heat both. But our seasoning also that we make, you know, we put that on everything but the coffee and the biscuits nearly. But it's the knack of blending flavors that touches your heart too, not just your stomach.
Now, you have packed a great deal of information into this book. I mean, let's not let's make sure that that our listeners know this. I mean, you have a glossary of cowboy terms. You have a set of characters that are wonderful. I mean, some of them don't even sound real. They're just so wonderfully lively and colorful. You have in here philosophy. You have your poetry. What else do you have in here besides the recipes? You have a lot of stuff in here that are extra from just the cookbook.
Yes, ma'am. When we were approached to have a cookbook, and it's been a dream of ours, especially of Shannon's, for a long time. And as people know that do cookbooks of this magnitude, it's a long process. But this is more than a cookbook. I tell people, hey, just like in our introduction, I wish I could shake your hand and look you in the eye. But if you'll just read this book, go through there and look at the pictures, I think you'll be able to see the view out my kitchen window is better than any other in the United States. You can smell that old mesquite as it cooks over there, boiling that coffee. The greatest day in the world usually happens every day wherever I'm at, because every meal's a holiday and every day's a banquet.
Now, you mentioned coffee. Coffee is a primary ingredient in a cowboy's daily life. And you say that you make an exceptional cup of coffee because you boil it, and the boiling is what makes it, it takes away all that acid that everybody so objects to.
Yes, ma'am. When you boil coffee and you boil it the right way, you have made smooth black magic, I promise you. It is the first thing I put on the fire every day, and it's the last thing that comes off. When you can share a cup of coffee with someone and look across the great places that we've been, why, it's better than going to any coffee shop in the world, too. And to boil coffee like that and get it to a good rolling boil on that old wood stove I call Bertha, you boil the acid out of the bean. You take away the bitter. I've had people that tell me, hey, I have never been able to drink coffee that didn't give me heartburn or indigestion, but I can drink this. And I said, well, thank you, sir. I said, it's because it's boiled and it's smooth. But just like that cast iron, them old coffee pots are seasoned sort of in a different way. They're rinsed out on the inside, and they've never seen a drop of soap.
I bet if you just put water in there, it would probably come out pretty brown.
Just put water in your coffee pot.
If you just put water in, it would probably come out pretty brown.
No, I mean, they're clean. They just get rinsed out really well, and then they'll turn upside down when we're through with them and let them dry out over the fire. Being enamel, you know, it's got a finish to it in there, and I don't like to taste metal, but I sure like to taste coffee.
Okay, so they're actually enameled inside and outside.
Yes.
Okay, I didn't realize. I thought they were cast iron too.
No, I don't boil water or anything.
No, you said that in the book. You don't boil water in your cast iron at all, because
it takes away the seasoning. It was that piece about you tasting. You got the taste of Cascade, but that was wrong.
Yeah, that was funny.
Yeah, and when you boil water in cast iron, especially if it's for any length of time, well, you turn your seasoning loose. Then the water in there becomes black, and people say, "Well, hey, I ain't going to cook in this stuff. It's nasty." Well, I ain't boiling water in mine, I promise.
Okay, now, it's really funny. When Anne was expecting our son 30-some years ago, one of the things that they noted was she had a very high iron count in her blood.
Yeah, my hemoglobin was way up there for a pregnant woman.
And you report exactly the same thing.
Yes. For years and years, my mother always told me that's why we eat out of cast iron. We never was iron deficient. She said there's two ways to absorb cast iron from eating it. Either eat it out of a skillet, she said, or I'll hit you with it, one of the two, but she was just kidding. But, the FDA or the USDA or one of them A's has finally, you know, realized that you can absorb iron from eating cast iron, and I don't want soil with aluminum or Tefal or anything like that. I just couldn't get a good mineral that I needed out of there.
Yes, and I mean, I'm a firm believer in it because I'm a perfect example of it.
But yes, ma'am.
Now, talking again about coffee, I believe you about your coffee and that you can get rid of the acid. We have a coffee maker now that it steams it, but it really swishes water all over it too. But I was really truly shocked to know that not only did you flavor a cake with coffee, your leftover coffee, but you actually put some used coffee grounds in it?
Yes, ma'am. My little wife came up with that creation one time. We was on the ranch, and, you know, cowboys have been the greatest experiment people I've ever had in my life because they're a pretty captive audience. You're in 70 miles for 5 weeks. Yeah. They can't run off and say I'm going to eat somewhere else. So we come up with a lot of creations for them, and we always ask, is this a keeper, or do we not make this again? And I've never had a cowboy in my entire life tell me yet, hey, don't make that again. Why don't you just make it 3 or 4 more times this week? But the coffee brew cake is a favorite of mine. I really like the taste. You know, it's sort of like a spice cake in a way, but the coffee flavor that's in there is, it's good for breakfast.
I bet. And breakfast is important, you say, so.
Yes, ma'am. Now, you know, there was an old fellow told me one time, he said, breakfast is the most important meal of the day, because if you ain't home by breakfast, you're sure in trouble.
Now, you know, I mean, there are many, many revelations in this book. I was amazed that the cook traditionally has been expected to also be a pharmacist, a doctor. You keep dental floss and so that you can stitch up gashes that the cowboys might get?
Yes, ma'am. You know, the cook has always been second in command, you know, on ranches and cattle drives for as long as you can remember. It's standard in the cowboy industry and chuck wagon both if you're cooking on ranches. The cook makes twice the wages that the cowboy does. But he also has them other responsibilities known as counselor, doctor, dentist, psychologist, everything in the world. And, you know, I've seen some things happen that scared me at times, and I've been fortunate enough to be able to help some people out when they was in a bind. But that just goes back to the same thing old Cookie did, you know, so many years ago. He was asked to perform so many tasks, and I've kept a tooth with J.B. Wells. Sure, it wasn't the best thing in the world, but when it's 5 degrees outside and that fella ain't breathing cold air anymore, he thought I was the saint. Exactly. Now, I don't think the dentist was too proud of my job when he went to him later about 6 weeks, but,
yeah, but you
get by with what you got, ma'am.
You have a whole section called Cowboy Cures. It was pretty amazing.
Yes.
And I loved your description of the spot you were where they had all the insects. You couldn't keep them off of you using anything. You said you even gargled with off.
Yeah, it was. That's on a ranch down by Abilene, Texas. You know, I would tell my wife these stories as we drove along when we first got together, and she'd say, "Do you have these wrote down?" And I said, "No, ma'am." And she said, "When we get home, you're fixed to start writing a blog." And I said, "I don't even know how to spell blog." And she said, "Well, you're going to start writing them." And my wife is a great editor and a great writer, too. And I enjoy writing. And that story come about from a ranch in Abilene, Texas, on a really wet spring to where them mosquitoes were big enough that they needed a landing strip.
So your wife was literary before. I mean, she was involved in the book business or in writing or something before you married her?
She's a college degree person. I mean, I tell her she's got a lot of common sense, but she is a great writer, too. I'll write something that's 1,500 words, and she'll edit it down and say, "Hey, I really need you to give me more of this or give me more of that."
Right.
So,
well, that's good.
You know, we work well together. She's a great coach, and that's what we wanted in this cookbook. You know, it's not a book that they had to hire a writer or someone to take the pictures. This book is all ours. When you open it, the pictures are ours, the stories are ours, the writing of it is ours. So that means a lot. And when we first got together, she didn't even know how to cook nothing. She was a microwave person only, but she has come a long way, I promise you.
Well, again, it's A Taste of Cowboy by Kent and also Shannon Rawlins. And congratulations on a job well done, and also for persevering in a culture that we come close to, we've come close to losing, haven't we?
Well, I just tell people, you know, they ask me all the time, you know, the cowboy's a dying breed, ain't he? And I just say, well, you can't see him from the interstate going 70 miles an hour, but as long as there's wide open country, especially in the western half of the United States, and there's a cow out there, there'll always be some old cowboy. You may not have ever seen, but he's out there, and as long as he's out there, I'll be feeding him somewhere.
Well, you're wonderful, Rawlins. I'm so glad we captured you for an interview.
Well, ma'am, it's been such a pleasure to visit with you and Peter, and y'all be welcome in our camp anytime, ma'am, I promise. And I won't do no doctoring on you, nor pull none of your teeth.
Good. You never know. We've accidentally shown up in a number of funny places.
Well, like I say, ma'am, the invitation is open.
Thanks.
We love to meet people, and since I've talked to you this long, I don't consider us family.
Well, good luck with your book.
All right. Thank you, ma'am, and God bless y'all.
And you too. Thank you. Bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Our next guest, we really have a lot of interesting guests today. Time Magazine has described Gene Bauer as the conscience of the food movement. Now, that's a really big role to have to slide into. And I wasn't sure before the interview, but I was truly impressed talking to him. You'll find Gene Bauer a very interesting and reasonable man. And, and sort of an idyllic lifestyle, too.
Right. So it's an interesting story. It's an interesting point of view, one that you should reflect upon just as we did when we talked to him.
Talk about an idyllic life. Gene Bauer of the Farm Sanctuary Life put out a book that if you look at it, you're going to want to rush into paradise immediately. Gene, welcome to On the Menu. And I'm sure that you put as much attractive material in as you would, because, I mean, you really want to get people to understand that there is a better way of life. And your particular mortal enemy is the factory farm, and we all agree with you about that, too. You do rescuing. First of all, let's say that when I say everything is beautiful and idyllic, you yourself are totally gorgeous. And you have a lot of pictures with you. And,
I hope he doesn't live close.
No. And you're a marathoner. You do Ironman, so you're fit and healthy. And you've been a vegan for how many years?
I've been a vegan since 1985.
And you're used to people actually coming to experience the sanctuary, the farm sanctuary life, and feeling moved to take up this vegan lifestyle as well, right?
That's right. At Farm Sanctuary, the animals get to enjoy life, and we're talking about cows and pigs and sheep and chickens and turkeys and animals that most people see primarily as edibles. But at Farm Sanctuary, the animals are our friends, not our food, and it's a very peaceful environment. The animals don't have to be afraid of us, and just coming and visiting and being immersed in that environment is very transformative.
Now, was there a singular event back in 1985 that caused you to head in this direction?
Well, I had always wanted to live in a way that didn't cause unnecessary harm. And I grew up actually in the Hollywood Hills, and I saw many animals harmed by fencing that was being put up, and I remember a deer getting caught in the fence who had to be killed, and that really bothered me. I just didn't want to contribute to that sort of suffering. And I started volunteering at Children's Hospital and working with people, and then got involved with environmental groups. And as time went, I learned more about factory farming and how harmful it was. So for me, it was really a process of learning about the industry and then also recognizing that I could live well by eating plants and not eating any animal foods and not contributing to the factory farming industry. So for me, it was really a learning process. And in 1985, one of the primary events for me was reading Francis Moore LePage's Diet for a Small Planet.
Oh, that's a wonderful book, yeah.
It's an excellent book, and just seeing how inefficient animal farming is, and then also meeting people who were vegetarian and vegan and recognizing that I could live that way, and that's what made the decision for me.
Now, here's a dilemma for you. I'm coming at you right out of left field. I'll give you a moment to think about it before you answer, so don't rush into it.
Okay.
Right now in the little borough of Mount Lebanon, Pennsylvania, which is right next to Pittsburgh and part of our county, Allegheny County, they're having a problem with a soaring deer population. So there are lots of wild deer who are invading people's gardens and chewing on their trees and generally being very disruptive.
But that's not the big issue.
Well, no. Well, I'm getting there.
The car.
So right now, I guess they get in the way of cars. That was the precipitating factor,
the number of accidents caused by deer running into cars or vice versa.
So here's the problem. The Mount Lebanon City Council's approach to this was they decided they would have a major cull of the deer crop, and they actually retained a firm that would round up and shoot 150 of the deer to get the numbers under control. Now, what do we do here?
These are dilemmas, and there is no easy silver bullet answer. I think what we ultimately need to do is to create an ecosystem that is balanced.
Yes.
And the reason that we have deer overpopulation problems is because we do not have a balanced ecosystem. The deer do not have their natural predators, and they don't have habitat to live in. So, you know, this is a big issue, and I think in the long term what we need to do is create spaces that are primarily urban, where people live and where the animals would never want to come, and then create wild spaces where deer and other wild animals could live in a balanced ecosystem. And then I think we would have less of these kinds of confrontations between wildlife and people places. And so it's going to take time, but I think approaching it in a way that is holistic and recognizing that the reason that we have these problems is because there's not adequate wildlife habitat and that we have created imbalance there where the deer population does grow out of control because they don't have natural predators anymore.
But there are so many things wrong with how they're handling this problem, though. I mean, idea of luring the deer into cages, locking them in there, and then shooting them at close range. And then they found out they were using the wrong ammunition because it took something like six bullets to kill the deer.
We don't need to go into the details.
It's
terrible. In the short term, what can be done are our sterilization programs. And there are efforts now to understand reproductive cycles. And so often what happens, unfortunately, is these hunting programs are defended on the basis of deer population control, but oftentimes it's really people that just want to go out and hunt. And, you know, if, for example, the goal was to prevent overpopulation, killing pregnant mothers would be the way to do that. But hunters are looking for the 10-point buck,
right,
which isn't really preventing population growth so much.
Right.
So sometimes the story given for killing these animals is not really logical when you look at what they're doing.
Right.
No, I understand. It just happens to be a topic that's right front page news at the top of page one of the local newspapers every single day, and I was interested to get your reaction because I knew you would have a thoughtful and logical response. Now let's go back to the farm. Now the farm is called again.
It's called Farm Sanctuary, and we operate sanctuaries in New York and California for rescued farm animals.
Yeah. Okay, so you have one where you came from, and now you have one where you went to.
I grew up in Los Angeles, but the first farm that we actually established was up in Watkins Glen, New York.
Okay, yeah. And that's where you are mainly yourself?
No, I now live in Washington, D.C., but I travel an awful lot. And I visit each of our farms from time to time, the one in Watkinsville, New York, and then one in Northern California and one in Southern California near Los Angeles.
And your traveling is to do with the mission of your farms.
That is correct. I travel around the country, meet with colleagues, talk about these issues, talk at various universities and at conferences, and amazing to see the increasing awareness and concern about factory farming. And there's a burgeoning entrepreneurial movement now of farmers and food people who are coming up with plant-based alternatives to animal foods. It's a very exciting time to be a vegan.
Yes, well, I agree. You're right on trend. And I think that Michael Pollan certainly contributed a lot to that. And you used his quote, which I love, is eat real food. Not too much, mostly plants.
I think that's great advice.
Yeah. And so the book now that you've written, you describe your history and your mission about rescuing the farm animals, and then you also provide guides to people in movements towards veganism. Is that
That's right. You know, one of Farm Sanctuary's primary organizational values is that we speak to people where they are on their own journeys, and we encourage people to take steps towards living more mindfully, more compassionately, more healthfully. So I'm a vegan, and we encourage people to consider a vegan lifestyle where you eat only plant foods and no animal foods. But if somebody starts eating more plant foods or decides to give up eating veal or other animal products that are particularly cruel, those are all very positive steps. And there are programs like Meatless Mondays where people meatless one day a week. And by doing that, people learn more about the kinds of plant-based alternatives that exist, and they learn new recipes, and they become more familiar and comfortable with eating vegan food. And that oftentimes leads them to eat more vegan food. And so it's incremental. And each person has to do what they feel right about and what they feel is good for them. And I believe that eating more plants and less animals is better for pretty much everybody in the country, and it's certainly better for the animals and the environment.
I think that's not really disputed. I think mainly people have come around to thinking just like that. Americans were the only ones that ate these huge quantities of meat because it was a rich environment. For producing.
Absolutely. And it's causing us health problems. You know, there's a movie serious health. There's a movie called Forks Over Knives that talks about how we could save something like 70% of our health care costs by shifting to a whole foods plant-based diet. And that is significant. Can you imagine if we could save 70% on health care costs? And besides the economics, there's just the suffering that people endure because of heart disease and cancer and other things, the risks of which could be lessened if we shifted to eating better food.
It's really interesting, Gene. I can remember in 1972, I came to the United States for the first time, and I can remember the name of the restaurant. It was called the Flame Inn, and it was next to Howard Johnson's in West Lafayette, Indiana. And I was first introduced to a piece of beef rib. And this triangular beef rib overlapped the plate on all the three points.
Wow, amazing.
And I had never seen a cut of beef like it in my whole life. It would have fed our entire family of five for Sunday lunch.
Yeah, you know, this idea of eating so much meat is a relatively new concept. And it's something that we are now recognizing causes a lot of harm to our own health. And so we learn from mistakes, and I think that's a good thing. And things are now starting to change in a better direction.
Now, here's the thing. Right now, in the Christian faith, we're in a meatless period called Lent. And I've always wondered, being something of a cynic, I've always wondered why Lent was invented. And it's my suspicion that if you go back to the Middle Ages, what used to happen with the villagers and their livestock is, you know, they killed them all off in the fall because they had nothing to feed them on through the winter. And then at some time in the spring, the store of preserved meat ran out. But instead of saying, oh, the meat just ran out. Instead, the church invented this concept called meatless months. And as a result, it drew attention away from the fact that, in fact, the reason that we were not eating meat was there wasn't any left.
That's a very interesting thought. I hadn't thought of it that way, but that is possible. And what I think it also speaks to is the fact that producing meat is very inefficient. You need to grow lots of grain to be able to feed animals. So you're wasting resources. You're wasting water and fossil fuels and soil. And if we grew plants and ate those directly, we could feed something like 10 times more people. So it is possible, as you say, that Lent was a way to justify and excuse meat not being available during that time of the year. And so I think that people get used to eating plants, but unfortunately we've adopted this habit of eating animals, and people get used to that now, and we're seeing the problems associated with that.
No, you have all animals. You don't differentiate or prioritize. Now they've proven you can save a lot on energy and better for the environment if you eat insects, but vegans are opposed to that too.
Well, I'm not a big fan of eating insects personally. But there are actually some vegans who advocate it. So
really?
It's not a simple answer.
My cousin who's vegan would not touch a drop of honey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let alone eat the bee.
Well, that's another one. And I generally don't eat honey either. But I think that I actually saw something recently online where there's this way of producing honey without actually having to go in and disturb the honeycomb where the bees are. So,
right, I've read that too.
To me, it all boils down to the relationship. And if the relationship can be mutually beneficial, then from my standpoint, it's fine. Now, can we have bee honey and be in a mutually beneficial relationship with the bees? That is a question. And I don't know the answer to that. And I would rather err on the side of not exploiting or causing harm. When it comes to animals that are raised for meat, milk, and eggs, there's no question that that is exploitive. You know, to get meat, animals are killed, and that's certainly not in their benefit. And so that's why, for me, being vegan, it's easy not to eat animal foods. But when it comes to the insects and honey and how we interact with those creatures, that's a little bit more complex. And just living, we're going to cause harm. Plowing up fields, for example, is going to cause harm. So to the extent we can lessen it, and be conscious of it, and intentionally try to live in a way that is mindful and respectful of everything. That's what I hope to do. But to me, that's really an aspiration, and it's a process. And as you learn more and you can do better, you do. But it's a process.
Now, do you feel like let's not call it a war, but that's an easy term to use, I guess. Do you feel like you're winning the war?
Yes, I think that there is more opposition to factory farming today than there has ever been before. And there is more availability of plant foods and alternatives to animal foods than ever before. There are companies now like Beyond Meat that is producing a product that is like meat made out of plant proteins. And it can be used as a substitute for meat. You know, there's another product called Gardein, or a company called Gardein, that's doing the same thing. And then we have Hampton Creek, a company that is producing mayonnaise without any eggs, and they're being distributed in thousands of retailers around the world. So they're, and then milk, you know, cow's milk now has competition from almond milk and coconut milk and soy milk. And there's alternatives now to these animal products that are very widely available and very convenient, and that is leading to big changes.
Now, what about, you just had Mark Bittman just move from New York to California, which is, for somebody as much a New Yorker as Mark Bittman, that was pretty amazing. But his latest is, of course, and this was directed by his doctor, I mean, in health considerations, it's vegan till 6, and then normal, I don't want to say normal because that would not be in keeping with what we're talking about, but you know what I'm saying, revert to omnivorism after 6. That might be a point at which other people could agree and sign on. What do you think about that?
I think that's true. If people decide to be vegan up until 6 o'clock, that is better than not being vegan up until 6 o'clock. Of course, from my perspective, it's great for people to be vegan up to 6 and also after 6. But for people who have never thought about being a vegan full-time, being vegan for most of the day and getting comfortable with eating foods that are vegan and understanding how tasty they are and understanding how to find them in grocery stores and in restaurants and how to prepare vegan food is part of learning. And ultimately, I think, could lead people to become vegan past 6 o'clock as well. So I support Mark Bittman's effort to encourage people to eat vegan up until 6. And I think that it's only in the benefit of people to do so. It improves our health, as you mentioned. Mark Bittman did this because he needed to eat more plants for his own health. And I think most people in the U.S., unfortunately, are in a similar position where our health is suffering because we're eating way too many animal foods. And shifting towards eating more plant foods, if not exclusively plant foods, will improve our health. And it will also improve the lives of other animals on the planet and will lighten our carbon footprint, lighten our environmental footprint as well.
And we've been going around on your themes and so forth, but I think that we need to point out that this health aspect is prefaced on your eating sensibly, even within the vegan boundaries. It's quite possible to be a vegan and eat nothing but starchy, fatty stuff and become obese. But you have the part of the book that we need to mention. You have a section on stocking the vegan pantry, all the new foods that are available to facilitate the preparation of vegan meals. And then, of course, you have how many recipes of really interesting foods?
Yes, there's 100 vegan recipes in the book. And as you say, there's a section on stocking your kitchen. The book provides very practical advice for how to adopt this lifestyle or how to take steps towards adopting this lifestyle.
Well, this has been an eye-opening interview with us, Gene, because you sound so sensible. You don't sound like you're proselytizing at all.
Well, you know, everybody has to make their own choices, and I believe that if people have good information, they're going to make good choices, and that's only going to benefit people as well as others.
I want to know how you found all these photographs of these adorable animals kissing each other.
Well, at Farm Sanctuary, the animals get to enjoy their lives, and we get to spend time with them. And there's amazing, beautiful scenery and beautiful things that happen there. And thankfully, we've been able to capture some of that with photos. And many of those are in the book. It makes you feel good to see animals having a good life. And I think that speaks to our hearts in a very positive way.
Well, you're doing a wonderful job, and I thank you for taking the time to talk to us about your new book. Again, it's called Living the Farm Sanctuary Life, subtitled The Ultimate Guide to Eating Mindfully, Living Longer, and Feeling Better Every Day. Gene Bauer with Gene Stone, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Have a great day.
And we hope you'll have a great day, too, and you'll join us again same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.